Okay, should we start? Okay, I'm going to talk really quickly through the Service Science Management Engineering Design because my assumption is you've already read it all. Yeah, I see these smiles. Like, yeah, you've
read it.
But I want to reserve some time to talk about generative pattern language and the both perspectives, open collaboration, Federated Wiki stuff. So let's think about. We've been talking about systems thinking. You kind of got the sense of systems. Is the thinking different in different types of systems? So we used to have agricultural systems. And agricultural systems work on the sun, right? And that worked well for thousands of years. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, and we had this new system where things, machines came in. And so we have this idea of service systems, and how is that different, or what would it mean? So let's go back in time. Let's say that Kelly's a farmer. Do you come from a farming family? Okay,
no.
So
actually, I think I do, probably.
A long time ago. Everyone was a farmer a long time ago, right? And we're all farmers, right? So I'm at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and I'm going to open a factory. So I'm going to come to Kelly and say, Kelly, you know, you're working like crazy. You know, your crops are not coming in very well. It's a really bad life. So what I think you should do is you come work in my factory. And says, oh, well, what's it like? And I say, well, okay. You know, it's we have air conditioning. It's warm in the winter. It's cool in the summer. We pay for vacation, so you could actually not have to worry about your fields, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's a good life. You come in, you know, it's not dangerous. You know, the animals are not going to attack you. We have a nice factory. And says, okay, great. I said, okay, you come in 9 o'clock on Monday morning. You start. And she says, you mean sunrise. You know, we work 9 to 5. Why do we work 9 to 5? Well, we work 9 to 5. But that means in the summer, you lose all the productive time when the day is out. And in the winter, you come to work in the dark and you go home in the dark. Like, this is a really crummy life. Or is it? So there's so much that's been around the industrial world, because industrial world works like that. It works on time, not solar time, but on machine time. If we're talking about service systems, you have to stop and think about, well, what does it mean now to work in a service system? What's it mean? What's the change? What's the frame of that? If it's information-driven service system, then does it ever turn off? Does it ever turn on? Do you think about the way you work differently? So one of the things that happened at IBM, it's got written up in the New York Times, is that quite a while ago, IBM officially stopped counting vacation time. So if you need vacation, take vacation, tell your colleagues you're going to be gone, but if you're off, you're off. And why do they do this? When they did the studies, it turns out that hardly any IBMer ever took the full vacation time they were allotted. And so everyone has a measurement. You know, you have a target. You're supposed to drive so much revenue, so write so much code, whatever. You have deadlines. You have projects. I mean, they're run. Why do you need a vacation system? So IBM took out the vacation system. And if you don't have the vacation system, you don't need the computer software. You don't need managers to read the reports. You don't have people putting in the time. Like, you just did away with all sorts of stuff. So That's an artifact of the industrial system.
I have a question based on that.
Go ahead.
Did they track afterwards? So there was no tracking of it whatsoever. They just were like, no.
No.
That's not really innovation as far as I can see. That's worker exploitation as far as I can see.
No, because it's really up to the individual. So if you use the system properly, what I used to do is I used to take off if I've been doing a lot of work. I would take off Tuesday afternoon and go with my wife to see a movie on, you know, Half Price Tuesday.
Yeah.
Because Tuesday afternoon, it's kind of like, you know, does it really matter? You take an hour off here, an hour there. So, you know, you can answer the phone, not answer the phone, decide, like, there's nothing. One of the big questions I have is, if your phone rings, do you answer it? And if it's a customer, you answer it. If it's an IBM, you're kind of look at No, they can wait. And if they call five or six times, and they, oh, yeah, it gets important, and they start doing stuff. But most of the time, we work on instant messaging and stuff like that. So there's a lot of behavioral things that happen inside of IBM. But sort of the instant messaging became the way that people worked at IBM. And so it was not uncommon for you to send, I'd send Kelly a message, and then 3 hours later, I get a response. And it's just sitting there, the window's sitting open. It's like, well, I guess she's busy.
I was sort of well known for having 20 to 30 instant message windows open all the time. 20 to 30 conversations at once. But they were not live because sometimes it took a while.
It's almost like someone's
like
email.
It's very shipping now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'd like to hear more about the worker.
Well, my point of view on that is you're functioning from the assumption that people will make healthy decisions. And that's not true. Like, that's not been my experience of human beings a lot of the time. People do all kinds of things that are unhealthy and bad. And I get it. Like, I get the idea of, like, yeah, we're spending all this time and infrastructure to, like, build this system that tracks this. People don't use it, and they don't. That happens all the time. But part of that is a cultural expectation of, like, this is a culture of work. And there's guilt associated with vacation, no matter where you work. I feel like there's always... Maybe not for you, and good, because that's healthy and normal. But I think there's a lot of people who are like, well, I can't take vacation because the client might call, and then what? You know, like.
Well, but you tell the client you're going on vacation.
It's not like, I know that, and you seem to know that, and that's really good.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people that don't. And
or there's the reverse, where they guilt you for not taking your vacation.
Well, yeah.
And then they're like, yes, but then the work.
I think it's slippery because the assumption that's based on is that people make healthy choices for themselves, and I think there's a lot of evidence that, like, we live in a society where people are massively obese all the time, and it's like that some of that isn't necessarily a choice, but some of it is like people are making poor choices about their life on some level.
So I think it's related to what I was going to say about this, and that is when you're system is an agricultural system or your system is an industrial system, it's really easy to see when you're doing well and when you aren't doing well. You know, how many of these things did you produce? How much of this got done? How many bushels of apples did you grow? When you're working in a service system, that thing is harder, so people just work more.
Yeah.
And
that's
what I think it's related to.
But okay, so let me tell you about one of the engagements I got. This is what I got famous for. In 2006, I got sent over to Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers, traditionally in film editing, what they would do is they would come in with all these reels of film, and they'd have desks that are like this, and then you work during the day and it goes down, and the next day it goes up, and it comes down again. And so they used to be able to track, you know, this person's busy, that person's busy, but it's a union shop anyway. So, you know, but they have, you know, someone needs something in a hurry, can you do a rush over here, this person's not too busy. Then they went digital editing, and there's nothing. Like, everyone's sitting at a computer, and there's, you can't tell. So the thing that I was working on for IBM, this is one of those deals where, actually, the reason that got really well known is IBM had been shut out of Warner Brothers for 10 years. And so when I got in there, I did the analysis and said, look, this is what you need to do. And one of the recommendations I meant is, what you want to do is not have a supervisory system. You want people to self-coordinate. So you want people to be able to see across their work team how much work is being done, because the peer pressure will allow them to self-organize. Like, if a person starts lacking off, the team already knows.
Yeah.
And this will just give them statistics against that. What you do not want to do is put in the command and control where the supervisor can see it. And we can design that in software. So if all the people on the team see where the work coming in and they see how it's distributed, they'll have their own ways of taking care of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But there is a service system that you can design in different ways. And it's non-physical. They're all doing this processing work, and it's like, and it turns out that when you actually understanding what the film editors actually do, the way that film editing works is that they were shooting originally on 35 millimeter film, and then in effect having a camera that would digitize that. Now they go direct to digital, but they should do that. And so what they would do is they would go through and It's like playing a video game with a mouse. You take all the specks of dust out, and that's what they do. But they themselves knew how much they had to do to get a film to deadline, and so they would make jokes that at the beginning of a reel, you know, you'd have better quality than at the end of a reel, but, you know, they're all mixed together, so you can't tell anyway. But that's the sort of thing they would do. So you can design systems to self-organize, and it's not just the technology. It's also the cultural system that's associated with it.
Yeah, I just think that cultural point is really important. What's triggered it for me is, like, your description of going from the agricultural to the industrial, and it's like, they weren't air conditioned, and it was very dangerous, and the only reason that they got better was because the social systems around them were like, hey, we're all dying, this is crappy, and, like,
yeah,
we're actually starving because we're not making enough money.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
like, it took, like,
yeah,
they don't just exist in their own thing, which I guess plays into.
Well, so this goes back to the original research at Tavistock. So in socio-technical systems, for those of you who are familiar with the Tavistock, in the 1940s, 1950s, the idea of socio-technical systems, and actually socio-ecological systems, socio-psychological systems as well, came up, and it was the original studies were of miners in Yorkshire. And what was happening was originally they were families, and they were getting sent down the mines, and they used to take care of each other, and then they brought in the machines, and when they brought in the machines, they had people, like, turn cranks and be part of the machine, and people were dying. So that's when they started doing these studies about work groups, and so there are a lot of phrases like quality of work life and job rotation, these sorts of things that came out of that research from an industrial age perspective. But we actually haven't had the same sorts of studies coming out in the service age, so that could be research project in itself, just, you know, what are the new ways of working now, and how is it that people should be balancing their lives associated with that?
Because it is, like, the boundaries part, I think, is really healthy, because it is, it's not like in the factory where you're like, I'm on the street, I'm looking for a job, like, I can work right here, I can log in, I can remote into my computer, and,
yep,
like, anywhere there's internet,
yep,
you can be doing your thing,
yep,
which gives you freedom, because maybe you need to be home, because the plumber's coming, blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
but
yeah,
then you can also be on the beach in Acapulco, where it's like, I'm on vacation, and you're like, no, you're not, you're living a lot, like,
right,
so
right, right. Right. Okay. So, what are service systems? This is Jim Spohr's definition. He actually talks about this, and then he writes about it obliquely. So I describe it a different way than Jim explains it. But I like the categorization when he was asked, "Well, how would education about service system be different?" And the way he did it was in terms of let's think about primary school, secondary school. And so what you want to teach is, firstly, systems that move, store, harvest, and process. These are the most tangible systems. So at kindergarten, you take your kid to school. You may take them on a streetcar or a bus. They learn about the transportation system a little bit. Water and waste management, you should teach them about the way that water moves, and that water just doesn't come out of a tap. You know, it comes out of Lake Ontario, it goes back. Food and global supply chain. Food doesn't just come from the supermarket. You might take it to a farm. Energy and energy grid, you could take to a power station in grade 3. And then by grade 4, information and communications infrastructure, they might have a mobile phone, how's it, this magic box actually communicates. Another set of systems that enable healthy, wealthy, and wise people, building and construction systems. People actually don't think about building construction as a service system, but it is. It's a huge service system, and there's a lot of opportunities for changing the way that things are done. Banking and finance, retail, hospitality, healthcare. These are all big systems, services, and these are ones people traditionally think about. Education system, this is the fun thing, is by grade 9, they spent 9 years in school, and now you kind of tell them this is how universities work. And then grade 10, learn about cities because they're concrete. Grade 11, regions and states, and then grade 12, nations, because nations are most abstract. So this works for the most concrete systems, the most abstract systems. But these are all service systems, so I'm not sure what you were thinking about in terms of what you're studying, but they should be in here somewhere.
These should have been the categories we used that day we walked around the things.
There is a definition. This is the one I like.
They read this paper,
so you don't need this one. One of the things about service systems as opposed to service science, and they're actually a service system science, is that there are people within the community that understand systems, and there are people that don't understand systems. And so the reason I use this definition is this definition stands up under system scrutiny. The language is actually okay by systems thinkers. And you know about moving from physical, from products to services and physical and material. Done this one?
Never done this one?
Okay, so this is a study by Apti, Kamrakar, and Nath. And the way you read this thing is you have products versus services, and you've got material versus information, and the economy is moving so that this moving this direction. So down here, information and services, this is Google, is getting bigger, and this part up here, which is General Motors, is getting smaller. And that's why we care about it, because the GDP in most countries, usually about 70-80%, is now services. Even in China, it's over half now. Creative class generates more wealth per employee. So these are the number of employees and the percentage that they create, so the percentage of wealth generated. And so if you talk about creative sector, this is engineers, artists, people that make things, as opposed to manufacturing sector. And the service sector in this definition is not what we think about when we think about service systems. Now you have to bridge over. But the creative class is traditionally what we think about when we talk about service systems that we've been talking about.
Has anyone read that, Richard Florida?
No? Okay.
Somehow. He's here, right? Is that? He's in Rotman.
Yeah. There's a $54 trillion system of systems. You use this one?
Yes.
Okay.
I was going to show it now. So go ahead.
Okay. No, I'll leave it for you then.
No,
I'll skip
you
over.
Do it. I wasn't showing the values. I was showing the complexity.
Okay. So there's a couple of ideas going on here. Firstly, I found that the idea of system of systems is an interesting language. It comes out of systems engineering. And so the systems engineers started to get influenced at IBM in a way they never did before. But when you talk about a system of systems, remember I said system thinking of perspective on parts, holes, and their relations. When you talk about parts, holes, and their relations, that means you get part-part, you get part-whole, and you get whole-whole. Whole-whole relations are really interesting, and systems of systems are whole-whole relations. They're ecologies. So you have various, you have the large one, infrastructure, transportation, big communications, leisure, and healthcare. So these are all big systems. But when we're looking in terms of improvement, here's where the challenge is. And this was, you can look into the study, but healthcare was the number one place where IBM saw a big opportunity. It's big and there's lots of opportunity for improvement. And in government education. Education is pretty small, relatively speaking. Building and transportation is pretty big. But if you actually look, now getting back to the IBM discussion, if you look where IBM has been putting its money on Watson Health, yeah. It's like that explains that. There was this phrase I claim that IBM should have learned, which were what's really changed and why are service systems different? It's related to the world becoming instrumented, interconnected, and intelligent. And what does it actually mean when you say that? It sounds really good and people learn that. And I said, well, the only way you're going to really learn about what that means is if you try to put the other side on it. So we're talking about a converging physical and digital infrastructure that is instrumented. Now, it used to be that the world was invisible or unobserved. So this changes the way that we actually have to the opportunities, the way we think about the world. Have any of you seen the stuff on Big Data University? There's meetups now. You might look at Big Data University. This is IBM telling universities they're too slow because most of them are being held down at Ryerson. Twice a week, there are courses being run by IBMers teaching how to do machine learning and statistics and all this sort of stuff. And why are they doing that? Because if you are taking statistics in the traditional way that you've been doing it, what you normally do, when they teach you first, do a sample, right? Okay, in an era of big data, why would you do a sample? Just take the universe. Just analyze everything. You need more data? Okay, get more data. It's no problem. As a matter of fact, we have so much data now, we don't want to do anything with it. So we need to think about how we're dealing with data in a different way. It's there all the time. There's lots of it. We have to deal with it on the fly. Yes?
I get your point, but a lot of linking stats, the point of doing samples is to kind of grasp the fundamental concepts within the statistics. Like if you're doing different distributions, when you look at the sample size, it's more illustrative rather than like real world to get your kind of mind around what is being taught.
Okay, So at BKU, what they teach is that, yes, you have to build a model, but what happens if the model changes faster than you can keep up with it?
That's just context specific. It depends on what you do.
Context, good word, which is systems, that's a systems idea, right? You're talking about the containing whole. So what's happening is that before you were doing analysis work, which was taking things apart, what's happening now in the new world of data is you're looking at the context change. So on your phone gives you a different response when you do a query depending on where you are. So you can build a model about where I'm standing right now, but it's like when I move, the model's going to change. So a different response is going to be required when I move, when I leave this and go home. So the world of, as invisible, unobserved, now we've got it so much, we have so much data, we have to rethink about that. That's how service systems could be different. Secondly, the world's becoming interconnected. And before, it used to have analog or synchronous connections. Now, everything is person to person, machine to machine, connected all the time. Everything is instrumented. So we have the opportunity for moving the data around. And the world becoming intelligent. Things are dumb or unresponsive to interaction. And so now we're into the Internet of Things. And so there's an intelligence. You can build it, you know, Raspberry Pis or Arduino or whatever, but all those things have an intelligence, and so the data is getting distributed around. So the way in which we think about service systems, if you're thinking about your service system on this side, maybe you should be thinking about the service system on this side. So as an example, if we're talking about a healthcare system where you didn't have data continuously streaming. So you've seen the Watson demos where they have the babies hooked up to monitors at sick kids, and they're like streaming continuously now. It's like, why not have them plugged in all the time when they're find out if they're going into fetal distress? Interconnected, can you do it person to person, machine to machine, and can you actually put the intelligence in the device? I'm going to skip the next slide because it's going to be hard. I'm going to skip ahead a couple ones. And I'm going to go and talk about pattern language. 15 minutes? You want to wrap it up in 15?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about generative pattern language. And this is the direction I've been doing research that's not been related to my dissertation, but now it is in my dissertation because I'm figuring out how to do this differently. There's this idea of wholeness, which was called quality without a name. There's an idea of unfolding. And I'm going to talk about Christopher Alexander's work on the Aitchen campus. So Christopher Alexander's architect at Berkeley in the 1970s, and he used to run this experiment, which was, if you're going to choose a carpet, do you prefer the carpet on the left or the carpet on the right? Now, when you say, if you had to choose one of these carpets, a picture of your own self, then which one of the carpets would you choose? And then you're getting this idea of what he calls wholeness. If we look at a service system, the basic question you could ask, does the service system serve? And if it serves you, then do you need it serving you in a different way from another person, or is it the same? You end up with this question of wholeness, and this is where the system thinking comes in, is that the quality of the service may not be something you can take apart. Well, I spent part of my time in Europe rereading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which I understand a whole much better now. I've been doing a lot more philosophy. But the question in that book was about quality. What is quality in a service system mean? And so Alexander had this pursuit. He wrote a number of books. The one he's most famous for is called A Pattern Language. This is the one that drove the design patterns literature in software. There's a timeless way of building, which was a how-to. So this is the patterns, the resulting patterns, descriptions of the features of buildings, towns, buildings, and construction. The timeless way of building is the way that you do it, which is like agile versus doing it in a waterfall method. And then the Oregon experiment, which is actually the planning guide for the University of Oregon campus. And so these three books were done together. If you were going to do any reading, I would suggest you not read these books, which are the ones that everyone read, and read this 2012 book called The Battle for Life and Beauty of the Earth. Now, that's a really gutsy title if I ever heard one. But it's what Alexandria was all about. And I got to talk a little bit about that. Okay, so what is a pattern?
Do people do design patterns? Do we learn about design patterns here in our faculty and some of the courses?
Lost knowledge.
I'm thinking of a course.
Yes. So, what is a pattern? A pattern is a recurring structural configuration that solves a problem in a context. This is Jim Copeland, who's now the chief methodologist for the Scrum Alliance. So in 2004, he started off with this pattern language stuff. It's a configuration to solve a problem in context, contributing to the wholeness of some whole or system that reflects some aesthetic or cultural value. He actually understands systems really well. He's a big systems thinker. So those words mean a lot. The only part I have a problem with is not with him, it's with Alexander, because the word problem, problematique, system of problems, and context. But you have a problem, you have a context in which it's solved, you have a solution, which gives you a resulting context, and you have forces that are considerations. Now, the forces are a tricky part, because the forces are what you're doing in architectural programming. You're actually trying to not do the design conflicts, you're actually trying to do architecture work, not design work. There's a rationale behind it, and there's some related patterns. So I'll give you an example, my favorite, intimacy gradient. Best way to describe intimacy gradient is that we have a pattern that occurs in most houses, which is you have a front door, you have a porch, you have a hallway. And so what happens is very, very few people make it through your front door. They're all strangers, right? So you open the door. If it's raining and the mailman's there, you usually ask the mailman to come in for a second, get out of the rain, they'll sign your papers for you, all sort of stuff. They've got a package. So people get into the hallway. Then if they're friends, they get into your living room. If they're really good friends, you're having a party, of course, everyone ends up in the kitchen. But very few people will ever make it to your bedroom. Very, very few people make it to your bedroom. There's a gradient there that you have hallway, living room, kitchen, bedroom, right? So those are gradients of intimacy. And it's a strong pattern. And it happens in a number of different places, entrance, public, semi-public, private. And it also it happens in the context. Now, there's a website, and it tells you that there's a higher order pattern and there's a low order pattern. So this is a containing system and a subsystem. So now we're designing systems inside of systems. And this applies to social media. So I don't know how you use your social media, but I'll tell you how I use mine, which is Facebook I use only for family, or people that are considered close enough to be family. And so you could try to friend me, but I won't friend you back. I use Google Plus extensively because of asymmetric follow, so I can follow people, they can follow me, I find there's less noise. LinkedIn, I have this rule that I connect to you if I've met you physically. An IBMer did that to me, and I thought, that's actually a really good idea. I don't connect to people I haven't met. I've broken that rule when I talk to people on video conference sometimes. I do break that rule. But there's a gradient there that if someone says, well, do you know David Ng? Then it's kind of like, okay. So I have the ultimate David Ng gradient, which is how well do you know David Ng? And if you know me really well, then I've cooked for you. Because when I travel, I stay in people's homes because I don't like particularly staying in hotels. So I stay in apartments, or I stay in apartments, and then generally people go, well, you know, these like, you know, I'm lecturing, they take me out for dinner, and say, well, actually, I don't need to be taken out for dinner normally, so I'd actually just prefer to use your kitchen. And then we have these parties. And so in Finland, this is one thing we're going to Finland and lecturing, is that whenever I do that, then I end up doing a dinner party for 10. We had a lot of fun. That's part of the intimacy gradient. So here's the question. Can we build better service systems learning inductively from architecting built environments? So I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Pierce, with deduction, induction, and abduction? No? Okay. Let me give you the short version of this. Deduction is like a mystery novel. So you don't know who did it until you get to the end. You read the whole book, and it's like, at the end, the butler did it. You go, great, okay? Induction is like a newspaper article. You get the whole content in the front first paragraph, and then explains the whole rest of the story comes after that, tells you what was in the first paragraph. Abduction is a science fiction movie. In a galaxy far, far away, they have this situation. Let's do Blade Runner. Okay, Blade Runner. What would it take to make Blade Runner true? It's close enough to true. These sort of things would happen, and then you'd have a real world like that. Now, you can do research in any number of these different ways. Most of the ways that people do research is deductive. You have a theory, and you prove the theory. So I have the theory, I collect the data, and prove it. Inductive. I have the data, and I'm trying to build theory. This is what I've been doing in my own dissertation. It works well in Europe. It doesn't work so well other places. If you're really brave, you could try doing the abductive thing and creating something, creating a science fiction one. This would be like future studies or scenario planning. What would have to happen to make this world true? You do backcasting. So the way that Alexander did this was inductively. And I say, here's the case. He approached the Aishin campus as a service system. He engaged with it and then creates a theory around it. And I'm going to do this, jump over a slide here and talk about the Aishin campus. So I had the great fortune of going to Japan last year. I go to Japan every year to participate in Jim Kojima's Service System Science Symposium. And the Friday, I was flying on like the Monday. On the Friday morning, I'm reading, and I go, oh my God, I'm going to be in Japan. I can actually go see a school that was designed by Christopher Alexander. So it turns out that you can actually order a book and have it delivered by 6 p.m., which I did. And so I had the book, and I sent the email, and I asked these guys, can I come and visit the school? And they had the site, which was this is Tokyo, and it's out here in the suburbs of Tokyo by Aruma. The idea was to create a combined high school and university campus. Google Earth looks like this. There's a little bit strange shape to the property. They put in a pond. And this is what it looks like when you actually fly over it. So you can't see the here, but got buildings in here. And how did Alexander do this? So there are 8 activities that he did in designing this. This is a summary of the 2012 book, which I'm really going to make brief. Interview on hopes and dreams. Make a poetic vision of the first sketch of a pattern language. Make the pattern language coherent. Refine it through discussion, get approval of it, renegotiate a pattern within the time and space budget, find systems of centers in the people in the land and the buildings, and then adjust the site plan. So I'm going to go through this very, very quickly. So the first thing, and think about this in terms of agile development, because this is doing agile architecture. So he interviews on the hopes and dreams. So what do you have? The main entrance is critical to the whole campus. You've got to do this. I want to fence and walls. And so from there, he creates a poetic vision where he has, okay, here's what it's like. Here's a description of it. And then create a rudimentary pattern language that's coherent. So he had all these words, and then he did sketching. And what he's trying to do now is place buildings on the land according to those ideas.
Those patterns?
The patterns. You refine the language. So you go back and talk to the people about it. And then there's a whole number of slides here about these are the patterns he actually used. And so here's the front gate, had an arc in it. It's supposed to be an important way. This is the way this, that starts off when you come in, entrance street to the main gate. You go through the gate, and you end up with this big space. At the end, there is that's where the cafeteria is. They have a judo hall. Number six, that was really quick. Negotiate the pattern language within space and time and money within budget. So what happened is when they first actually did it, they came up with a 17,990 square meter estimate, but they had 13,000 square feet. And so we came in and said, what I want to do is I want to reduce all of this down to 13,000 square feet because all you can afford. But in order, if you do that, the only way you can add something is if you subtract it somewhere else. So they cut it down. They took it. They took this down to 73. All of this down to 73%, and then they renegotiated everything. And that's how they decided it. Find the system of centers in the people's minds and peace in the land. Now this is the tricky part. As an architect, you can actually change the land or you can change the buildings. And so this is where the system thinking comes in, because what you're doing is this. You're moving buildings and land around simultaneously and trying to place them on top of each other. And it turns out the way that you end up doing it is having to move some of the stuff around. There's a little swamp land, there's a ridge, sorts of things. And eventually he made a little balsa mock-up of it and got it all to work. Then finally, adjust the site plan on the site itself. And so in this case, what he did was not build blueprints, but he was actually on the land and he put up flags and markers. And so when you see the arc and the path, that's because he was actually standing there and looking at it and looking at the land. So there's a lot of things here. Now, the reason that I suggest looking at Alexander's 2012 book is he changes his language over 25 years. And so what he used to call wholeness, what he used to call quality without a name became called unfolding wholeness. And you're going to get confused if you go the other way around. So it's much easier to read the later work and then establish on that. Okay. Now, this is going to be something that you're going to encounter and coming around to the back end here, is that there are development philosophies that are teleological and ateleological. Okay, so teleology is the pursuit of ends. And so when you're doing teleological, you have a goal or a purpose. When you're doing ateleological, you're looking for wholeness or harmony. And when you actually look at designing systems, you end up having designed one way or the other. To cut this short, I'm going to flip over to talking about Federated Wiki, but I'm going to use that as an example here. The wiki was invented by Ward Cunningham to support development of pattern language. So the two of them go together. And today we see Wikipedia, and we think that was kind of, forever, and that's the way it was done. But what happened was that you had a pattern that connects to another pattern, and how you're going to keep these hyperlinks all together. And so that's why Ward invented the wiki. But it's also an example of a different philosophy, because when you're building wiki doesn't have a purpose. It's a tool so you can build something else, whereas building an application would fall on the teleological side. So I'm going to close out quickly. I promise the time here. As I said before, wiki was invented to support pattern language. This is the original C2 wiki. And has a front page and has design patterns created in it. But the way that we're working on these now is there's a problem with wiki. The problem with wiki is there's only one truth in the world. And so Ward's come back and said, let's create a different wiki that fixes that. It's what he called Federated Wiki. Have people here use GitHub? Anyone know Git? Okay. Oh, great. Okay. So Git is an example of a non-blocking system. What happens is that people can edit. So I can work on chapter 1, Kelly can work on chapter 2, you can work on chapter 3, and as long as we don't mess around with each other, when we do things in parallel, we can bring them all together. Right? And so that's the architecture that we look at in trying to do this. So Git was invented by, it's the number 2 invention of Linus Torvalds. Number 1 invention of Linus Torvalds was Linux. The number 2 invention was Git. So this is Federated Wiki. If you do a search, you'll find that the ward has been doing this, and this is a direction I'm playing with because I think it's the right direction. I haven't figured out if it's the right technology. I was on Federated, he has a video call every week, and so last week I was surprised because not only is Ward on this thing every week, but Kent Beck was on it last week. Kent Beck was one of the other people that was at the invention of Wiki and invented pattern language. So it's kind of fun working with these guys. But the idea is that each of us has a wiki, so we'd have 30 wikis in this room, and we'd be able to drag and drop content between them. It would automatically do the updates between them, so I would know that that I got the original idea from Kelly, and then I changed it. And then she gets a notification that I've changed it, and she can look at it and say, nah, it's different. But then on this other page, it's like, no, I like that, and then she forks it back. So a different architecture, a different way of working on this. And for this, I've been working on it. I put in Christopher Alexander's 1968 multi-service centered pattern as an experiment.
So you think this is a model for articulating the system?
So I think that service system number one should be done in a pattern language.
Okay.
And number two, I think that the way we should do it is we should have do it in a federated way. Because it's not only going to be just one context. It's going to be have these descriptions about this is one way of doing it under these conditions. So if we look at the examples that Alexander did, oh, I don't have them in the slide deck. What happens is he has these multi-service centers. And this is back in the 1960s, and so the idea that you had all government services in one place was a new idea. But he has a pattern language where one of them is for San Francisco downtown, another one is for New York out in the suburbs. And so it's the same services, but when you're designing a multi-service center for an urban area, it's not the same as when doing it for a suburban area. So this one requires no parking spaces, but requires lots of transit. The other one requires more parking spaces because no transportation. But they both provide the same services. So that's the long-term
direction. And if you have an existing service system that you're trying to revamp, you would just have to get it into this.
You should be able to describe it
into here.
Yes, and so the pattern language first it provides you for the patterns that could be used descriptively or normatively, and then you combine the patterns and they create a whole. And there's a quality in the whole that is not necessarily in the parts.
Okay.
That's a general idea.
Nice.
So the last part I gave you was rather rapid. It's research in progress, so you'll know you've heard it, but you probably won't see anything in the next couple of years, or next couple of months anyway. So I'm going to close out and give you this idea about service systems. So you're going to study a service system, but the question that you may be asking is how can I improve that service system? You need to think about the research method by which you're doing that. Because I've given you the ideas at the beginning about episteme, techne, and phronesis, but now I'm also giving you the idea of deduction, induction, and abduction. So you can do this in the science fiction kind of way, which is I'll improve this service system. The ultimate service system would be this way and provide a vision of what the better service system would be and then provide the bridge that says to get to that science fiction, I would need this. You could do it deductively, which is to say we've done analysis work on other service systems. So this works in universities, so we could try doing this in hospitals. Or you can do it inductively and say we see these patterns and these little behaviors that we want to bring up as features.
Nice. Great. I'm sorry, I'm taking copious notes. Are there any final questions for David before we thank him?
They always get that look after my lectures.
It was a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Got everybody.
If you really want, you can watch the video where it's gone the other direction, and it may. The advantage of the video is it has a pause button.
Anyway, I wish to thank you very much, David.
Thanks.
very different perspective.